In this episode of Keeb FM, I get a chance to speak to Molly Sheets. Molly is the director of engineering for Kubernetes at Zynga and leads the platform engineering for the games behind hits like Words with Friends. Yes, even the new Pope is a player. We explore her team's Kubernetes strategy, including their adoption of Cilium for eBPF networking, Argo CD for managing over 25 cluster add-ons, and their interest in Capsule to handle multi-tenancy more effectively. Molly breaks down why one cluster per team isn't sustainable, how slowing down deployments can actually increase risk, and what metrics truly matter in a multi-tenant environment. If you work on shared platforms that care about Kubernetes architecture at scale, this episode is definitely for you. This episode of Keeb FM is brought to you by LearnK8s. Since 2017, LearnK8s has provided training all over the world to individuals as well as to groups, in person and online. Courses are instructor-led and students have access to the material for the rest of their lives. For more information, check out learnk8s.io. Hi, Molly, and welcome to Keeb FM.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Yep. So what are three emerging Kubernetes tools that you are keeping an eye on?
So at Zynga, we're keeping an eye on specifically Cilium, which people are using for eBPF networking, Argo CD, which we just adopted for over 25 add-ons that we manage as part of our clusters, and Capsule, which we're really interested in because we found hierarchical namespaces to not be a good fit for our use cases. So we're looking at Capsule.
Very good. Now you've kind of given a hint about where you work, but can you tell me about what you do and the company where you're working right now?
Absolutely. So I'm Molly Sheets. I'm the Director of Engineering for Kubernetes, which is a division in our Zynga mobile game tech organization. Our organization is really a platform engineering organization for the mobile studios we have, and we have some non-mobile games as well under this unit, but we focused on serving our game developers with the tools and infrastructure that they need in order to get games out the door as fast as possible and have high availability for their backends.
Fantastic. Now, before we started the recording, you mentioned a couple of these games and also some of the folks that are playing them worldwide. Is there anything you can share about that?
Yeah, so we're part of a bigger parent entity called Take-Two Interactive, which is a public company with a lot of subsidiaries. Most famous, a lot of people know of Rockstar, which is working on the next Grand Theft Auto game. They might know of 2K, which has NBA 2K, as well as Gearbox Software underneath it, which has Borderlands and Bioshock and a lot of fun games. And then we're under Zynga, which has a lot of mobile games. Our popular ones are like Words with Friends. We found out that the new Pope plays that, so we're really interested in that. And then also Zynga Poker, Game of Thrones Legends, a lot of interesting games with a lot of cool IPs. So we get to work on serving those customers.
And before you got into all this, what did you do, how did you get into cloud native?
Long journey. So everybody's story is really interesting, right? And we don't all come from the same backgrounds, but there are some common patterns. I actually started out my career in game design. So I didn't even start off in engineering. And this was over a decade ago, right when the iPhone came out. The tools changed. We started off in Flash and then went to Unity. And so I picked up the client. I noticed as part of that journey that analytics was really important, and I started to learn the analytics technologies that power games. And that started my journey on AWS, which is how I got into cloud native. So 4 certifications later, including a couple specialty cert, I started building in Kubernetes. Yeah.
And, the Kubernetes cloud native ecosystem moves very quickly. You mentioned certifications, but what works best for you to stay up to date?
Oh, dear. We were talking about this earlier. I love LearnK8s and everything that has been created over there. I think that's a fantastic platform for anyone who's trying to pick up on Kubernetes technologies. All the articles that come out, Kube Careers is a great resource for people as well. And then just reading the Kubernetes blog and the CNCF blogs are absolutely helpful for me and my team. We look at those a lot. And as well as hopefully going to KubeCon this year. It's based in Atlanta, which is I am. So it'd be great. Sorry, let me repeat that. We hope to go to KubeCon this year, and I'm based in Atlanta, so that would be really convenient for us.
Nice not to have to, cross any ponds or travel cross country to get there. And Molly, if you could go back in time and, share one career tip with your younger self, what would that be?
Just it's okay to learn new things and try new things and don't be scared about those things. I think in our industry in particular, it's a really challenging industry because it's hit driven. And so we always have to create new games. We have to investigate new technologies and we have to move at a really rapid pace just because someone has put out a white paper that says this is the best practice. You don't necessarily have to be stuck with convention and red tape. Try new things. Be the people that write those white papers. And that's always stuck with me. But it took me several years to get comfortable with kind of changing the established standards.
And with that in mind, like you said, being part of the change, you know, doing the writing, we found several different articles interesting, you know, coming from your side. And so we want to dive into these a little bit deeper in our conversation today. So as Kubernetes deployments mature in organizations, we often see increasing bureaucracy and processes that slow down delivery. Is this trend absolutely inevitable, or is there a better way to approach Kubernetes operations at scale?
Yeah, I think a lot. So I was watching a wonderful reInvent talk about EKS and Adobe's journey on EKS, and they started out, my interpretation of this talk was that they started out as cluster as a service and then moved to an internal developer platform, but they had years in between there. We're very much in a similar boat. And I think a lot of people start off thinking, I need my own cluster because that's where they come from and they're scared to do multi-tenancy. But they learn that the operational overhead of maintaining your own clusters is significant. If you look back at a lot of articles 4 years ago, you'll see like Mercedes-Benz had hundreds of clusters, Chick-fil-A, hundreds of clusters. It would be interesting to check in on those teams now to see if they're still doing that today. Because in my experience, people kind of hit a mark where they're like, we can't keep hiring people through this problem. We've got to try something different. And then they say, let's try multi-tenancy. Let's do something really different.
Chick-fil-A, Mercedes, we're looking at you. We need to get some feedback. No, but I think it would be really interesting. Like you said, it's one thing to say it a few years ago, where are they with on that, you know, their process nowadays. You've also made the provocative claim that intentionally slowing down Kubernetes deployments is actually associated with being architecturally less resilient. Could you elaborate a little bit on why you believe this specifically in the Kubernetes context?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the book Accelerate. I don't know if you've read that book. A lot of people have read it, and it's years old now, right? And the Dora metrics have had a lot of longevity for people to experiment with. But one of the kind of discoveries in that book was that if you add external approvers to things, that slowing people down actually can cause more risk than letting people deploy faster to production. And when people go and design Kubernetes systems, they're obviously re-architecting from a standard EC2 stack and moving it to Kubernetes because they want to just isolate, you know, the deployment of applications and have multiple applications to deploy. As part of that model, you have to focus on isolation almost purely. And at that point, you should be able to release faster without affecting other people. If you add in these manual gates of people reviews, you're actually not usually addressing the things in your system that prevent kind of codependencies and risk. So I would rather break things, fix it permanently, and then keep moving on and deploying faster and break things smaller and smaller. And that's actually, you know, over time, people have realized that if you move faster and you break things with lower severity, you are more safe than you are if you have these kind of manual approvers in as part of your release process.
You also make it an interesting analogy comparing slow-moving organizations to ships without compartments that sink when hitting icebergs. What architectural approaches could help organizations become resilient to failures?
Oh, that's a good. That's a great question because there's so many different things. So first off, having codependencies with other teams that you don't talk to regularly is extremely challenging. I was talking to an engineer recently, or a fellow at our company who's super brilliant. His name is Josh, and he said, treat every dependency as if it will attack your stack. And that's really changed my mental model on it because for me, it was always about codependency mapping. But if you approach it whereas everything is a threat, then you start to design your systems to mitigate against that threat. So if you see rotation as a threat, well, then do you have pod disruption budgets, for example, in Kubernetes? Are you using the best practices for limits and resource quotas, right? Do you think you could affect other people? you know, that's kind of how we think about it is, can things affect us and can we affect other people, and what procedures could be put in place to prevent that?
And with that in mind as well, you know, it's very often from talking to people that, you know, have been with Kubernetes for its, you know, the entirety of its existence, as well as folks that are newer, that as much as we're talking about technical challenges, the human challenges that are there often, a lot of people would say, outweigh them. And when it comes to these aspects of communication, we've also discussed the topic of silos. In the organization where you're working right now, how do you approach this, you know, on the human side? Yes, it's great to have all those technical skills, but in order to ensure that there is proper communication, because when things break, and they will, is there going to be a blame culture? Is there going to be a lot of finger pointing? How are those things going to be treated in the best way possible?
I think we have a really good incident culture, and I'm very proud of it. And when I'm interviewing employees, future candidates and employees, I tend to ask around this question to get their experience and see if they've experienced an incident culture before, because not everybody has. If you come from a startup, the way you handle incidents may be really different than an enterprise organization or a AAA game studio even. So that's really important to us. We have blameless postmortems, of course, but in how that actually works out is they're giant docs that we contribute to and work on together and really talk through. And then if there is, you know, a mistake or an incident in production, it's about as fast remediation as possible and tracking how fast did we remediate the issue over time. Incidents can happen from anywhere. That's what I tell people. It's not always a change that we've made as engineers. And honestly, the worst incidents that I've seen in my entire career have often been so complex at the end of the day that you can't point to one change as the main reason that this happened. You know, you could have a downstream dependency that falls over because of something that happened a week ago. And I think it's really important for people to realize how complex our systems are today. You have some follow-up questions that are similar to this, but one of the books that I've read that I really love was recommended to me by a mentor, was called The Fearless Organization by Amy Edmondson. She talks about what are called VOLCA failures, which are essentially complex failures you have to celebrate instead of blaming people so that you can get through them. And that's kind of how I think about incidents these days. You should be celebrating them instead of being of them.
And to quote one of my favorite philosophers, Bob Ross, we don't believe in mistakes, but happy little accidents. So yeah, I definitely agree. Definitely a big believer in that. Good. All right. So many companies organize their Kubernetes clusters to match their team structure, with each team getting their own separate cluster. You've suggested flipping this approach. How can organizations design their Kubernetes architecture first and then structure their teams around it?
A lot of organizations, the platform engineering model is taking 40 to 60 applications, whatever you need to not repeat in your organization, and putting them on the same cluster, because the past model was monolithic applications, right? And I'm using EC2 as an example because I'm an AWS junkie, but there's also Azure, you can use GCP, whatever your flavor. And the reality of it is today that there's a lot of things people don't want to repeatedly make in organizations. If they are building a lot of games, especially, it makes sense to centralize those into one cluster that's a multi-tenant cluster. And then for big games, really, really big games that have a lot of custom workloads or regional-based dependencies for low latency, they may need individual clusters deployed closer to their end users. So for me, I ask people, evaluate your game and your timeline. What is the fastest way that you can get to the first metric that you need so that you can launch and test with real players? And that's how we look at architecture today.
You've also warned about what you call a dangerous ops and business trap in Kubernetes adoption. Organizations continually add projects, headcount, and clusters. What happens when companies take this one team, one cluster approach, and what evidence suggests that it's unsustainable?
So the this is why I would love for you to check in with other people, because I'm pretty sure they've started to see the same thing, which is that you can't keep adding headcount to manage clusters. If you have a centralized model that's a cluster as a service model, that team, it might be a maintenance team. So what they're maintaining is Kubernetes version upgrades, add-ons upgrades, and maybe other additional components like monitoring. This is what our team does. We make sure we upgrade Kubernetes 4 versions twice a year. That's a lot of work. And the more clusters you add, the more complexity you add. It's not as simple as clicking a button in the AWS console and just saying, upgrade in some cases.
It isn't.
Especially in multi-tenant clusters, and if you have new workloads on there where you're not sure if people have put in the best practices, you have to work with those teams and educate them and check their applications, make sure they aren't going to be affected by a rotation. You have to understand, are they running stateful sets? These things matter, and the more clusters you have, the more complex that becomes, and the more you have to be vigilant once you do the applications. Also, the larger the clusters you have, if you've got thousands of nodes, you're dealing with complexity and rotations, right? Where you might have to start writing automation. Otherwise, it's like watching paint dry. And you have to think through the actual strategies for these upgrades. So I think it's not sustainable in a single cluster model because the operational overhead for people to actually do it is hard.
And it seems that the core alternative to cluster proliferation is embracing multi-tenancy in Kubernetes, which often gets a bad reputation. What are the most common misconceptions that teams have about multi-tenant Kubernetes, and what specific features make it more viable than many might realize?
So a lot of people are like, I'm sharing physical cluster space with another team, and I'm worried they are going to affect me. And they absolutely will affect you if you don't have the best practices in place. So having limits, not necessarily for memory, more importantly for CPU, but having CPU limits, in the case of games workloads, CPU is often more important. Having resource quotas in place is extremely important. And then thinking through the underlying requirements as well on the host level is important. I say this because there are usually shared agent dependencies as well in clusters. And you don't want that dependency to bump off everybody if it starts using too much disk space, right? So what we have to do is monitor every aspect in our team. We're monitoring the low-level resource usage and also the application resource usage. And once you have those practices in place, you're in a good spot.
Now, let's just see if we can take a deeper, closer look at multi-tenancy challenges in Kubernetes. What are some of the most difficult aspects of implementing effective multi-tenancy, and how can teams overcome these hurdles?
So we talked earlier about org structure, and there's a really good article on the inverse Conway maneuver, which is basically talking about how people tend to organize their architecture around their existing team structure instead of organizing their team structure around what they want their architectures to be. That's really important. So a good example is a lot of people talked about Amazon being the products mimic the org chart. I think it's really important for the products to mimic what people need more than the org chart. And that actually is important for Kubernetes specifically because of namespaces. So if you want teams to have isolation, you want them to have isolated namespace. You don't want to throw everybody into the same namespace. I think that's what's really hard is sometimes people start their journey in Kubernetes and they just get a couple of namespaces and then they're like, oh, I understand it now. I understand the purpose of these structures. And then they got to go back and kind of rethink what are our access patterns for RBAC and how are we going to do our namespaces? They also use them differently. What I've found too, some people use namespaces for environment and deployments instead of just as team constructs. This is why we're really fascinated by Capsule, because how do you enable people to do both? Have a team namespace and then have within that team namespace, sub-environment namespaces like a stage namespace or a prod namespace in the same prod cluster.
And even though you generally advocate for multi-tenant clusters, you do acknowledge that there are legitimate reasons to create separate clusters. In a multi-tenant strategy, when should teams actually consider adding clusters instead of enhancing their existing shared environments?
Great question. The main use case, I would say, for having separate clusters is when you are hitting latency dependencies or compliance requirements that absolutely need you to be isolated from other people. For example, if you need to launch a game in Asia Pacific, you probably want to be closer to your players in Asia Pacific, just on a physical cluster location level for the parts of the game where latency matters. So let's say it's a battle royale style game. You're going to want the aspects where they're all shoved into the part of the game where they're playing against each other over there. But maybe for transactional elements like purchasing, you may not need that to be really low, really low latency, right? Our players notice, and it's really important for us to serve them with the experience that is best for them. So location has a huge impact depending on the type of game. Another reason to have a separate cluster is for critical workloads that during a major incident would be ones you'd want to handle first and isolate, but not to label a specific incident, because as I said, incidents can come from anywhere, but let's say a third-party provider or a cloud provider went down, you might want, and went down means a lot of things. AZs go down and you need to shift everything to another AZ, it is a bit easier to do it on a cluster by cluster level and say, okay, critical workloads go first on a bridge. So those elements matter.
In multi-tenant Kubernetes clusters, resources can become constrained during high demand situations, such as you said, you know, whether it's a release or a moment, you know, peak in traffic. You've suggested that sometimes teams need to prioritize certain workloads, even if it means gameplay stays live and all monitoring bites it. Just like going down bites it, cannot be different definitions, but it can mean so many different things. How should teams approach these difficult prioritization decisions in shared environments?
So you never want to lose visibility, right? But if the choice for me is between temporarily losing visibility, some aspect of visibility, because usually you have multiple ways that you're monitoring your system, or keeping pay live, like in-app purchase transactions live, just as an example, or keeping the ability for players to launch individual sub games inside of a laundry game live, I'm going to let monitoring just die. Ideally, you put in the best practices, so that's not possible. You might have an external monitoring system that's not part of the same cluster that you manage. So maybe you don't want to run Prometheus and Grafana on the same cluster that is the cluster serving the workloads. You might have a separate monitoring stack. And a lot of people use third parties as well, like Datadog. If you look at our jobs, you'll see that we use Datadog. So that helps keep that scenario from being a problem. But let's say it was, because you maybe need to ship logs or something like that. Priority classes become really important. And making sure that the gameplay is priority. Any application critical to gameplay is priority over things like logging systems. So, yeah.
You mentioned that common reliability metrics like control plane uptime and node availability aren't very useful for measuring the health of multi-tenant Kubernetes environments. With that in mind, what metrics should teams actually be tracking instead?
It's a great question, because you have different teams, right? You have the infrastructure teams that are maintaining, or DevOps teams that are maintaining the core infrastructure, and then you have application owners. And both of those contribute to a total holistic view of Kubernetes uptime. The reason control plane isn't as valuable to a company like us is because we use EKS in Amazon. So a lot of aspects of the control plane are actually managed by Amazon, such as etcd. Whereas if we were running on-prem Kubernetes, control plane would probably be extremely important metric to care about, and Kubelet and all that stuff. But for us, just SLOs on the individual applications and add-ons is really critical. I want to know, for example, we use Cilium. I want to know that the Cilium agent is functioning and live and operating as intended and not getting killed. Because that's going to affect every other workload due to it being a networking component. And then I want to know the health of external DNS, for example. And then application owners, for what they've written and deployed on the cluster, they want to know that their services are live as well. All of that contributes to your total distributed uptime. It's really hard to get that metric because you would need SLOs for everything in the system. So a node dying isn't as big of a deal for us, as long as we're running hundreds of them, or we have multiple nodes for the pools that matter.
Building on these more meaningful metrics, you proposed the concept of theoretical maximum availability for platform health. How can teams create this comprehensive view of reliability in shared Kubernetes environments?
I wish it was easier to do in external tools. So if anyone is listening to that, us from any monitoring tools, it is still really hard today to do that. I did a shout out to Datadog at one point because I think they are trying to do this. They have like easy integrations for some health check endpoints for commonly deployed Kubernetes add-ons. And I love that we're taking advantage of that, but they don't have everything. As I said, we manage 25 add-ons, and all of them we need to do to build SLOs for. So that just takes a lot of time. And then you have to make sure that your SLOs are set to the values that you actually want them to, right? You have to wait and kind of see what happens. And it's a huge investment. So you have to build an SLO for each add-on, and then you have to have all your application owners build them as well. And that's how you get to the theoretical maximum availability. In an enterprise, so much, because you've got thousands of applications.
And with all these considerations about multi-tenancy, team organization, and measuring reliability in Kubernetes, what final advice would you give to platform teams that are trying to build and maintain shared Kubernetes environments that truly serve their organization's needs?
I would think about what you need for your business more than the perfect pristine architecture you want to build. And you'll find that you will still get quality. So I think there's a lot of fear that people have of saying, well, if I don't do it this way, the quality of our services and our offerings will go down. They're very worried about if I don't have account isolation, right? If it's not team per account, they're worried that they'll have security issues. Think through those problems when you say security issues, what you mean, and you may find that your quality actually won't be impacted and that you'll start implementing and really learning Kubernetes and the best practices for RBAC. That's really what I would advise people to do, is get familiar with the unfamiliar.
So I think I see a lot of sometimes, you know, friction or struggle with engineers trying to figure out, okay, I have all this technical knowledge, but now I'm being asked, you know, to link to, you know, business critical, really thinking about, you know, the effect of the technologies that are being used from a business perspective. And perhaps it's not a knowledge base with which they're terribly familiar, and then often feeling that they're being asked to do way too many things. What advice would you give for engineers out there that might be struggling with this in terms of having a better business, you know, understanding of how the business works and how that should be informing technical decisions?
So if you're an engineer that came to the games industry and you went through cloud and DevOps as your kind of point of entry, go play some games. Seriously. There are a lot of free ones. A lot of our games are free entry. Like, you can get started playing for free. Play them and try to put yourself in the shoes of the developer. These days, a lot of developers have to get a lot of content out the door to stay on top of players. Players really, really want new content. They're hungry for it. And so they're constantly churning out content. That's a very tricky space to be in. And it means that that's priority, getting content out the door. Once we understand the time investment of our customers, for us, our customers, our internal game teams, it helps us really think through the problem space from their perspective and value the changes that they want to see in that way. So it's weird to say it, but play games. Play games if you want to be a better engineer in the games industry.
I think that's great. I think the same idea could be applied, to lots of other industries. Obviously, in this case, it's somewhat easier to, you know, to get direct access to that. But when be hungry for empathy. You know, how can you understand better what problems that they're trying to solve, whether it's, you know, around user experience, whether it's around availability, whether it's around speed, comfort, ease of use, all that kind of stuff. So I think there's a lot to be said for that. Also, if you could say, what's the one thing that you think people what's the one thing that most people are getting wrong about platform engineering? As it's a paradigm that we've been discussing a lot over the last few years, big buzzword bingo, you know, shifting from DevOps to platform engineering, a lot of different opinions about that. But what do you think people are getting wrong about it?
There is this, I think it's because of the hype around it. There is this eagerness to have internal developer platforms with a shiny UI interface right out the gate. And this kind of this elephant vision that we got to draw the elephant. And the problem is that there's so many steps on the way to get there. And it's okay to live in that pain and those steps for a little bit and truly understand what people want. Because you may have a vision in your mind to build this really cool IDP where people can just apply like a team name and they get everything they want, and then realize that what everybody wants is different. And that what you need to build is different. They want different kinds of databases. They want different networking configurations. Or some customers don't want to even care about that at all. And we have, in cases, I've seen this at Zynga, but I've also seen this before Zynga, when I was at Principal Solutions Architect at Amazon and talked to game teams, different personas. There are personas that really want to get deep in DevOps and want to have access to everything. And then there are people that want so much abstraction, they don't even want to write Terraform. They don't want to know what it is and they don't care about it. They just want to interface with APIs. There are people that want like a UI pretty console view of all their services. And then there are people that just want a CLI. And the investment to build all those things is huge. Don't expect it to happen fast. It doesn't happen overnight. And don't get mad when you're still living in some Git repos that you're cloning and some wikis and you're still figuring out, you know, why is this still a Jira process? It's okay. We'll all
get it. And I think it ties back very nicely to what you mentioned at the very beginning, is that, you know, being eager to and willing to learn, you know, that there's always going to be some learnings going on there. So your first assumption, it's normal that you may have it, but you shouldn't necessarily expect it to work for absolutely every single case. And like you said, there are many different personas out there.
So also, welcome back from maternity leave. Many women in tech navigate these career transitions. So we'd like to know a little bit about, you know, are there any surprising insights that you'd like to share about returning to work after this time away? Any changes, anything you think folks out there should know?
First off, shout out to my parent company, Take-Two. And I think Zynga had a similar model before this. They gave me a lot of leave time. I still haven't even taken 10 weeks of it. And I can split it up and take that before 1 year is up. I just wanted to come back and wait a little bit longer for my kid. But I still took like almost 4 months of leave, which is amazing in specifically the United States, where we don't have federally mandated maternity leave. So thank you.
A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that that's the case. But yeah,
I cannot list, I actually can't list a single woman, and I know a lot of women in this industry, who have been able to take consecutive maternity leave for 4 months. Most of them are either unemployed, because we've had many layoffs in this industry, some of whom were who were laid off in like 8th or 9th months of pregnancy. It's really sad. And I am extremely grateful to my company for letting me just take it. Just actually getting to do it is incredible. As far as coming back to work, it's definitely a fire hose, but I'm really grateful to Justin Schwartz on my team and Kevin, who is on my team. They both stood in for me. They're engineers and they're very senior engineers. So maybe if other people are out there that are managers that take it, give your engineers an opportunity to try management. They'll find they either like it or hate it, but they'll definitely learn what you actually do very, very clearly. And I think it's a good opportunity to kind of share knowledge in that way. So thank you to them for standing in. Yeah, it's hard to come back. It really, it shows you the value of time in a way that I thought I understood before, and now I understand it on a different level. I don't know if you're a parent, but time is hard to find. People have noticed that I don't write every weekend anymore on my blog, and I'm like, that's because I got to choose between my blog and my kid.
I think we're more than happy to accept, you know, lower frequency of blog deliveries. That's not a problem. Thank you for sharing that. And shout out to your teammates, Justin and Kevin. Perhaps we could have them on the podcast at some time to share their experience of what it's like to jump into management. That could be good. Good. Now, yeah, you know, you did mention your blog, but apart from that, and we also talked about KubeCon, what else is next for you, Molly?
Oh, gosh. Well, we're definitely continuing our multi-tenancy journey and fleshing it out and try to find new ways to get games out the door as quick as possible. That's really important because you got to try new things with players and try new ideas. And it's so important for us to, we call them bold beats at Zynga. It's so important for us to try new bold beats with our players. So we're focused heavily on that in our organization in particular right now. And then for me, KubeCon, this will be the first time I've ever attended. Which, do you go every year? I don't know how many times you've attended. Probably
every year, multiple times a year.
Yeah, so that's huge for me. I'm so excited about that. I couldn't be more excited. So we'll see.
Fantastic. Molly, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
You can follow me on LinkedIn. I guess we'll probably share it as like a little caption or something like that. That's the best way to get in touch with me. Just reach out to me on there. Yeah. I also have a blog.
It's how we found you. So we'll definitely be sharing a link to your blog as well. And anyway, it's been fantastic talking to you and learning from you. Have you ever thought about writing a book?
Oh, yes. But do people read them? Do people read more books?
You do. You do. You've mentioned several books. Of course.
I read. And of some books, shout out to Honeycomb, who wrote with a bunch of other people the Observability Engineering book. That's a killer book. I do read some technical books, but I read mostly technical blog posts. And the New Stack is a good one. I didn't mention that in that earlier question, but the New Stack is great. Lots of Medium blog posts. I just like short content is great. So
okay.
I don't know, maybe.
Looking forward to if you decide to do that. Molly, thanks so much for sharing your time with us today. Look forward to crossing paths with you in the future and seeing you at KubeCon in Atlanta.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. So nice to talk. Really appreciate
Likewise.
It.
Take care. Cheers.